It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. James Davolis is a portfolio manager at Horizon Kinetics. He serves as co-portfolio manager to the Kinetics Internet Fund and is an investment team member of the Kinetics Paradigm Fund, Kinetics Alternative Income Fund, Kinetics Global Fund, Kinetics Small Cap Opportunities Fund, and Kinetics Market Opportunities Fund. James is also directly responsible for a variety of custom and concentrated equity managed account strategies, is a co-portfolio manager on certain private funds, and is on the investment team across the core managed account strategies. He's a member of the firm's investment committee and research team and is actively involved in research, valuation, and portfolio allocation for many of the firm's high conviction investments. James joined the firm in 2005 as a research analyst. He earned his undergraduate degree from Loyola University of Maryland in 2005 and his MBA from NYU in 2016. On behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, James. Please go ahead.
Thanks, John, and thanks everybody for having me. So at Horizon Kinetics, I would consider us to be contrarians, but not for the sake of being contrarian, more as a function of where the opportunities exist and where we can find high, strong opportunities, mostly driven from a valuation standpoint. So with that, before I delve into the presentation today, Viper Energy Partners is a company that we believe to be systemically and structurally undervalued for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is its sensitivity to commodities. So before, again, going into the company in detail, I would note that investor malaise through commodity companies is probably reaching an extreme right now where the energy operating companies, as evidenced by the iShares Energy Select ETF or index, has underperformed the S&P 500 by almost 1,500 basis points annually over the past decade, while the VanEck Gold Miners Index has underperformed the S&P by 800 basis points annually over 10 years. This is in spite of materially higher gold and silver prices compared to a decade ago, and marginally higher oil prices. So clearly something doesn't work with operating company investments, or it hasn't, although we believe that there is a niche that is vastly underappreciated by investors within the commodity sphere. So here's an introduction to royalty companies. Most people are probably somewhat familiar with royalty companies through the lens of precious metals, and the preeminent royalty company is Franco-Nevada Corporation, which is a gold and precious metal focused royalty company that actually traces its roots all the way back to 1983, when Pierre Lassonde founded the company in Canada as a financing mechanism for gold mines. The returns from 1983 through 2001 were staggering, although it's not quantifiable directly due to the fact that it was a private company. But in 2001, it was acquired by Newmont Mining. Newmont Mining then actually grew the business, but listed it through an IPO slash spinoff in December of 07 in order to fund a new royalty portfolio acquisition. So the chart that you see here shows roughly Franco-Nevada's performance back to the spinoff out of Newmont Mining. And it's compared there to the Gold Miners Index, GDX, which has had a pretty substantial capital loss over that period. Meanwhile, gold prices, again, are up materially, but over a 10-year period on an annualized basis, not that strongly. So just to differentiate, gold and silver royalty companies are primarily a financing mechanism. And what that means is they will provide upfront capital for a mine in the form of cash, which allows the mine to be developed. But rather than taking a cash interest payment, the company buys future production from that mine, usually in terms of ounces of gold, silver, potentially metals in the platinum metals group, at vastly discounted rates. So an example might be you provide $100 million day one, you expect production to start in year five. Spot gold prices at the time of financing are at $1,300 an ounce, but your forward purchase commitments are at $200 an ounce. So that discount provides an inherent interest rate in that loan, and it's proven to be very, very successful, as you can see in this chart. But it makes sense for the mine and the mining company as well, because they can't really take on large corporate level debt and cash interest obligations. So it really serves both end markets quite well, meaning the financier and the miners. So Franco has historically been gold focused, some silver, again, a little bit into the platinum metals group. However, recently they started to invest in energy royalties. Energy royalties, as opposed to gold and silver royalties, are typically a function of land ownership. And land ownership, we'll use Texas as a case for here, Viper Energy. And with land ownership, you might sign an operating lease with a provider if you're a rancher and you own the mineral interest. So, for example, we can use precedent transactions where the oil and gas company might pay you an upfront payment of $50,000 to $70,000 for a premier acre in the Delaware Basin. But on top of that, they're going to pay you 20% in a standard transaction of all oil and gas produced from these wells. So this is more of a function of land ownership as opposed to a financing mechanism. And there's a lot of confusion amongst energy royalty companies, because a lot of the companies that are public today that are quote energy royalties are actual fractional interests in liquidating operating leases. And we'll go into exactly what that means in the next slide, but you can look at certain examples of Permian Basin Trust, Sandridge Permian Trust, Prudhoe Bay Trust, and the San Juan Basin Royalty Trust, where these are typically wells and fields that are in steep decline. There's no new capital expenditures going in. There's very little new drilling. And as a result, they're valued on a current yield basis and effectively a dividend-based rate. Viper is amongst the new breed, of which there's about five or six that are publicly traded, energy royalty companies that are growth-oriented. So Viper was taken public in 2014. It was only a one small patch of royalties owned by Diamondback Energy in what was called the Spanish Trail Formation in the Midland Basin. Since then, Diamondback has facilitated Viper being a highly accretive NAV growth entity, where they've grown production, royalty acres, and distributions meaningfully above the underlying assets as a function of active management. So right here and there, you need to differentiate between the old standard of a liquidating royalty trust versus an accretive growth-oriented royalty company. So before we delve down further into Viper, let's just define exactly what a royalty is. So on the left-hand side, you see an illustrative working interest, and this is using $40 barrel of energy pricing. That actually includes, for BOE, that's barrel of oil equivalent. That includes a certain mix of gas and natural gas liquids, so propane, butane, natural gasoline, ethane, that are the more liquid stream of the gas stream that gets blended into a BOE. So that's why they're using $40. Anyway, if you look at the margin on what might be a working interest, where let's say Pioneer has a working interest in a well, They're paying $2.50 of production and ad valorem tax, $6.50 of operating, which is basically lease operating expenses and transportation. So piping that oil or gas from a gathering system to a backbone pipeline to a hub. And then $14 might be a little generous in terms of finding and development costs, which is exploratory drilling, all of the things that are necessary before you can even get that well and get that oil out of the ground. So you're looking at a 43% illustrative margin. Compare that to the royalty well on the right, where all you're paying under a standard royalty is your production and ad valorem tax of $250, where 94% netted back to the royalty owner. So the economics are extremely compelling. On the right-hand side is a standard operator economic of how much of a PV10. For those unfamiliar with energy industry, that's a standardized metric of a discounted 10% NPV. So again, if you're looking at a well-level IRR in, let's say, the 20% range, which is very low today, even at $45 oil, 70% of the economics go to the royalty owner. At a 50% well-level IRR, 40% go to the royalty owner. So then let's also talk about exactly what the different types of royalties there are, because not all royalties are created equal. So the most common and the example I gave of where a rancher would lease out his or her land is a mineral ownership. In the state of Texas, it's just known as a mineral interest as opposed to a surface interest. And it's basically just a perpetual interest to exploit the minerals in that land. And you can sign a lease with whoever you choose to exploit those minerals. The middle is a non-participating royalty interest, which is basically a carve out where you do not participate in any expenses, any of the taxes. It's 100% cost free. So if the operator of that well realizes $70 a barrel and you have a 10% NPRI, you get $7 free and clear. The third is an overriding royalty interest, which is basically part of a working interest override, which is much more similar to the old standard of these liquidating, declining trusts that I just mentioned. So I'll just give you an illustrative example of how this works with minerals, where you can see in number one there, the minerals have yet to be leased. In this case, KRP is Kimball. It's another publicly traded comp. They have all the expense on themselves, but they have all the revenue. Step two, they actually do the lease where they get the upfront cash payment. This is where they just own the minerals. In return, they basically share the economics with the operator. And you know, depending on where you're at, you might be spending $6 to $8 million just to drill the hole. And then all of your finding and development costs are tens of millions of dollars, your transportation costs. So you're spending zero capital. You're letting somebody take on that burden. And in this case, you might be taking 20 to 25% of the economics for your trouble. So if you look at step three, revenue might be 20 to 25% to the royalty owner. Operator takes 75 to 80% of the revenue, but cost 0% to Kimball, 100% to the operator. One of the best parts is these are not perpetual leases. So in the case of the Delaware Basin, you know, you might want to be exploiting a certain layer and you can only do that within 10 years. That reverts back to the royalty owner upon lease termination. So the benefits of royalties relative to a fee simple or working interest, zero working capital requirements. You're literally cashing checks. Minimal OPEX. In the case of some, you might have a little bit of shared if it's an NPRI, which is not does not pertain to these companies generally that we're talking about today, but you have some production tax and ad valorem. Zero working capital or CapEx. Typically, you use minimal or no debt funding. Since you don't technically control the wellhead, most companies have historically only used debt through a revolving credit facility to finance new acquisitions, and then they plug that through an equity raise. Finally, you have exposure to both production growth and commodity price growth. I view that in a way as a free call option, where some people would view that as a negative, but basically a 30-year leap on oil prices, if you threw that into a Black-Scholes model, it's going to spit out a massive premium, not a discount, where people are worried about energy prices exposure. So finally, Viper Energy Partners. Viper, again, was created in 2014 as a limited partnership. It has since converted to a taxable entity effective May of this year, which we'll talk about at kind of the end of the presentation. But if you look at the chart on the left, this was historically towards the middle of the screen, and I don't know if you can see Midland County, but some of those green squares was their original acreage. And since then, they've expanded into all of this other acreage. If you zoom out to the chart on the map on the right, the shaded area in the top, which goes into New Mexico and then parts of western and even central Texas, that's the greater Permian Basin. On the Viper chart, they separated into the Delaware, which is newer, far deeper and more robust resource, but it was more complex. Therefore, it's been far less explored than the Midland Basin, which has been explored for quite a while. It's a little less deep, a little less complex, but it's more of the known entity. So basic statistics here is you've got 124 million shares. They used to call them units. The market cap is pulling from 1221. We're about 15% higher today. I had to put this into compliance before the break. Today, they have net debt of about $280 million, but then liquidity on the revolver of $275. So then you get to an enterprise value of $3.35 billion relative to net royalty acres of 13,908. Now, a net royalty acre, for the purpose of this discussion, there's different nomenclature in Texas private markets. For the purposes of this conversation, a net royalty acre nets out the royalty interest per acre. For instance, if you have a 20% royalty interest on 1 acre, 5 acres will be one net royalty acre. So delving into the assets itself, I think most people are familiar with how prolific the Delaware and Midland Basin are, but I don't think they have a true appreciation for the actual economics here. We're starting with the Midland Basin, which you can see on the map on the left is kind of the left part of the greater Permian, the right part of the greater Permian. On the right-hand side, you see what looks kind of like a layer cake, where you have 8 layers of, these are shale beds, which are basically geological zones of when carbon basically decomposed into what is now hydrocarbon-producing rock. That rock is very porous and brittle, and you break that up, and that's how you kind of frack and create these huge wells. So really basic math, and this is borrowed from RSP Permian, one of the best operators in the basin. It was actually bought by Concho in July of this year. 46,700 net acres, 1,600 locations. Now locations mean it's a new location for every layer, for every well you do. So in this map, you see Wolfcamp A. They might do 12 wells in Wolfcamp A alone. Then they might do 6 or 8 in Wolfcamp B. So that's how you get to so many locations. The important thing here is 1 billion barrels of resource through these acres. So basic math is you just divide that the 1 billion barrels by 46,700 acres. That comes out to about 21,000 MBOE is nomenclature for 1,000 barrels per acre. So that's that's pretty important when we look at what is a net royalty acre worth. Now, I mentioned that the Delaware Basin is a bit more robust. So you'll notice here again on the left-hand side, Reeves, Ward, Loving County, going up into Eddy and Lee County in New Mexico. Here you have over 9 layers where the Wolfcamp A, which is really the most robust part of the basin, it's so large you break it up into the Wolfcamp XY and the lower Wolfcamp A. So similar math, you've got 45,200 acres, and they're saying 1.8 billion potential resource. That equates to nearly 40,000 barrels of oil equivalent per acre. Now, another thing that I think there's a lot of misinformation about it is exactly what are these wells. So this is a core Wolfcamp A well in the Delaware Basin from RSP Permian. And on the left-hand side, you see the cumulative production of the well. On the bottom, you see the months of production. So this is a 1.5 million barrel well, which is a very large, robust well in the core of the basin. As you get out into the fringes, as you get into more densely drilled, you're not going to have such robust wells. That's why we model between 600 and 700,000 barrels per well, depending on where you are exactly. But something that you will notice is around 15 months in, you are already at about 450,000 barrels. So basically 30% of the well in the first year and a half of well life. So it's good in the sense that you're getting a lot of oil very quickly and you're getting your capital return. So your IRRs are benefit immensely from that. Negative press will say, well, there's a huge decline rate. So you have to keep on drilling to keep that up. And that's true. But again, these are high IRR wells. And you know, the companies out there now there's pad drilling where they're very efficient and very fast with their drilling. Now, going back to the barrel of oil equivalent, the BOE, for most of the basin, you're getting about 60% liquid oil, 20% of those NGLs we talked about, and 20% dry gas. Dry gas is methane, where you see Henry Hub pricing today at about $3. I mean, it spiked to $5. Most people's long-term decks are below $3, but more to be said about gas in a minute. Here is some simple math that we've done, which shows an NPV of what one of these wells would be if the acre was drilled immediately and started producing tomorrow. So if you look at the bottom, before you go up to the chart, the benchmark pricing, you've got West Texas Intermediate Oil, which that is delivery into Cushing, Oklahoma. At 46, I mean, we're up to closer to 50. It got down below 45. You can't update the deck fast enough today. NGLs, again, that difficult to price properly, but you generally look at about 60% of liquid oil pricing. It really depends on how much propane, butane, and natural gasoline are in that stream, whereas ethane and the drier stream is a little bit cheaper, and then, again, dry gas. So the pricing here is, again, using a weighted average of 60% oil, 20% NGL, 20% gas. That gets you a composite of 3672, which quite low, actually, relative to what people think these wells are realizing. However, let's take the Delaware Basin as an example. So at spot pricing, assuming that you are going to do each acre has 40,000 barrels for the Delaware and 20,000 barrels for the Midland. We then use a 17-year decline rate where, again, obviously it's very heavily loaded to the front where you're getting a third before you're at the half-year mark. Discounting that back at a 7% discount rate, for the 40,000 barrels per acre, you get an NPV of $1.1 million per net royalty acre. For the 20,000 or 21,000 in the Midland, you're getting about 580,000. So again, that's a 17-year type curve discounted back to present value at 7% using current spot pricing. Now, let's look at Viper Energy Partners and see where their implied acreage price is, where here you take a pretty simple math, your enterprise value divided by your net royalty acres. That gives you an imputed value of about $241,000 per acre. You can see on the right-hand side at $25 to $30, you're right in the $250 to $280 range of what the implied price per net royalty acre is. Clearly, there's a big mismatch between that and $1.1 million and $580. So just going on to the next slide here, if you look at the top right, again, that's using the previous slide where we're assuming that's producing day one. So if you go down to the bottom right, this is discounting future production. Again, we're still using the 7% NPV, but we're assuming a weighted average of 10 years until production. So some will produce within the first 10-year window, some will produce at year 10, and then obviously others going out further, where there's about a 30-year resource to kind of look at how the full life cycle of drilling within the current inventory is. So again, here, you use spot pricing. The Delaware, again, gets you to about 560. The Midland gets you to 300. Based on their mix of acreage between Midland and Delaware, they do have a little bit of Eagleford. You're around 425,000 per net royalty acre using this fair value method. That would equate to about a $50 stock relative to the high 20s today. However, I would argue that that's probably quite conservative because that assumes zero price recovery in hydrocarbon prices, and we'll go into our views there later. Assumes no growth, meaning there's no accretive growth, there's no drop downs, there's no extended timeline to the resource base. And it also assumes relatively slow development consistent with there's currently certain bottlenecks in getting oil and gas out of the basin, so on and so forth. So quite conservative. I think you're in a fair value of about $400,000 per net royalty acre using spot pricing. Now, spot pricing is a huge point of disunderstanding for people, especially as it pertains to the Permian Basin, where this slide is borrowed from Viper in their third quarter. And, you know, it basically just gives you where guidance is at, where production is at. And this is the distribution per unit, the DPU. But most importantly is if you see the circled number, the 54.51 was the average, was the realized oil price that Viper realized in the third quarter of this year. Might not seem too crazy today, but if you took an average, a simple average of this of the 90 days in the second quarter, West Texas for Cushing delivery averaged close to $70 a barrel during that quarter. This is basically a $15 spread where Viper was realizing this huge discount. And this is a result of a pricing differential because they were delivering mostly into the Midland hub. Because the growth rate in the Permian Basin exceeded even the most wild forecasts. And so there simply just wasn't enough pipelines to get oil up to Cushing and realize that 70 bucks. So it got stuck at Midland. So if you look in this chart on the left, this is Plains All American, who has a lot of pipeline capacity and infrastructure in the region. Far left, you'll see a blue cluster there, which is the Midland hub. So the Midland hub typically is a lot of their capacity today goes up to the northeast of Cushing, which is right in the middle of the screen with that red dot. Interestingly, all of the capacity being built, so that the red cluster all the way to the left side is the Delaware Basin, whereas the blue is Midland. Midland City's right in the middle there. But those green lines coming down to the right, Cactus 1, Cactus 2, there's a joint venture, there's a couple other pipelines. They're actually delivering into the Gulf. So Houston, there's a Magellan contract you can track to see where Gulf-based pricing is. But Gulf is benchmarked to Brent. So Brent crude, which is a North Sea contract, has averaged about a $10 premium to West Texas Intermediate. So West Texas, let's say 45 bucks when I did this slide, Brent was 55 bucks. So as you get to the Gulf, you're not going to realize full Brent pricing because you have to pay what's basically a seaborne transportation fee to get it to those hubs. And there's a lot of very complex reasons why Brent trades at a premium to WTI, notably the API gravity and refinery configurement. Also the fact that the U.S. has a glut of oil and gas relative to infrastructure and refining capacity. Also a little bit to do with sulfur and European refineries preferring having a much higher diesel and bunker oil mix. However, if you eliminate by the middle of this year, the chart on the right is Raymond James Financial. They show kind of a straight line production estimate for the Permian. And then you can see the backlog easing up in the second quarter of 19 and then really catching up in the third quarter, where some new pipelines, the Epic Pipeline, which is a private company, Sunrise, which is Plains All America, Gray Oak, which is Phillips 66, and then Cactus 2, which you can see down there on the left. You're going to have overcapacity to get the oil and gas out of there by the end of 19. Probably you're going to see a lot less congestion by the middle of the year. So going back to this previous slide where they were getting $55 at a $15 discount to WTI, you'll eliminate that Midland differential, but then you'll actually add $5 to that, give or take, as you start realizing Brent pricing as opposed to getting the Cushing WTI price. Now, another thing that I think is really hard to put into your valuation is the new growth-oriented royalty companies have really focused on, a lot of them come from the MLP mindset, where investors are so focused on yield and they're just laser-focused on accretive acquisitions. And this has created a massive mechanism of accretive unit growth where you can see the acquisitions that Viper engaged in 2018, ranging from at the low end about $20 million up to closer to $200 million. The operators on the left, I didn't break out exactly what basins they were in, but virtually all of these are Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and a little bit Eagle Ford, which is that BP, Devon, Conoco. But you'll notice you're trading at an implied value of about $250,000 an acre, but they're buying anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000 an acre. And that's basically a function of where the market's at. The market is not giving you any value for unproducing acreage. So they're valuing the current acreage at, look, we're yielding 8. We need to buy this at a 10% yield to make it accretive. Otherwise, we're not going to buy your property. So what ends up happening is they can buy the unproducing acreage at a massive discount, the producing acreage at a slight discount to where they're trading. So you end up using, let's say you're buying it at $150 an acre, you're using currency valuing it at $250 an acre, highly, highly accretive long term. Again, I mentioned that mechanism where you use a revolver to close day one. That gives them a lot of operating leverage and a lot of scale where not many people can write a $175 million check day one. Fill in that revolver, plug it with an equity issuance, issue shares, it very powerful accretive growth mechanism. The other aspect is Diamondback continues to be a majority shareholder, and they have a very large equity interest in Viper. So they don't want to alienate this cash flow stream to the parent company. So they've continued to drop down mineral acreage and royalties as they've made acquisitions and as they have had success in developing more and more resource. So the drop downs come through a mechanism of two things. One, acreage that was not previously producing goes into production. Now there's a cash flow. Now you can drop it down. Two, they've been pretty aggressive with acquisitions. So Brigham Resources, to name one, as that portfolio has royalty acreage, they can drop that down and they do what makes sense for everybody. So, you know, we're looking at a steady state using $45 oil, NPVing the royalty stream, and you're getting to $50. I would argue, you know, you should give some value to this growth mechanism on top of just getting your 8% dividend yield today. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk quickly about oil prices. Obviously, it needs to be discussed within any conversation of these assets, but there's a lot of misinformation about what a break-even is. You've seen certain more promotional CEOs talk about 20, even less break-evens in the Delaware Basin, which maybe if you take the very, very best acreage and you have extremely efficient pad drilling, you can drill a well and make money break even. So that's assuming a 0% IRR or profit margin at 20. But that doesn't include many, many economics, which here's a chart that RS Energy did. It was in the Wall Street Journal. But they're showing the break even that you might cite for the Delaware Basin at 35 at the low end. That's just a well. So what's my cost to sink a hole, get the oil up, transport it, and get my money back? What do I need to break even just looking at that? You see the next dot at $45 for the Delaware, where it says, well, what if other overhead costs are included? Not the least of which is corporate SG&A. You have debt service, where a lot of these companies run at about 3 to 4 times EBITDA, a little less, 2 to 3 times EBITDA debt, where you know their cost of capital is not cheap. You go all the way up to $50 when the price of land is included. But you know, one thing that this RS Energy study did is they included a 10% profit margin, which you know these are rational capital allocators where you really need a rate of return. And PV10 is a standard in the industry demanding a 10% rate of return. So this gives you a much better idea of, you know, where is the pain threshold. So, you know, you're at $50 for the Delaware. And fact of the matter is, not many people in the Delaware Basin are getting anywhere near $50, given the fact that oil WTI is at 49 something last I checked, but you know they're still getting a $10 haircut going to Midland. The other interesting aspect that I forgot to mention about the turnaround in differentials for Viper this year is you see about 20% of the barrel in gas. Gas in Henry Hub is about $3. But Waha, Texas, which is a small West Texas gas hub, it actually got to the point where gas delivered there was getting virtually zero in the fourth quarter of this year because there was too much gas and it cost money to store. And if they couldn't store it and they couldn't move it, it was actually a cost for the hub to take that gas. So again, as you get capacity to get that out of there, you're going from what was quite literally zero up to $3 for that gas. The NGL mix obviously has a lot better economics. I mean, there's a lot of ethylene crackers being put into Louisiana, Port Charles, Corpus Christi, Texas. So that's a much stronger market. Moving over to OPEC and the large international oil providers on the graph on the right, you really need to look at them from a fiscal break-even. A fiscal break-even is what does it take to balance their budget? So you see this is Brent taken yesterday at $58.24. So based on their budgets, technically you've got Iraq, Russia, Kuwait, Qatar, all technically still balancing their budget at $58 Brent. But you've got some very, very large producers, the UAE, Oman, Algeria, Angola, and most importantly, Saudi Arabia at $88. So the Saudis have an estimate of about $500 billion of reserves in their federal bank. And, you know, if you're $30 below your break even and you start to bleed 5, 10, 15, 20, I mean, right now it might even be well above that if these prices hold in your national coffers. You know, geopolitics aside on what's going on over in Saudi Arabia, bleeding the reserves through low oil does not help anybody. And, you know, these guys can't just sit there and wait this thing out. And, you know, Putin and Russia have been pretty resolute in saying they're fine, but, you know, he's not too far off either. Further up, you've seen a lot of supply disruptions in Libya, Nigeria, with rebels and different factions taking supply offline there. And you're nowhere in the universe of them making money. So the economic break-evens for oil are well above 45 West Texas, 55 Brent. And there was a lot going on in the fourth quarter. I mean, I can go on about algorithms and trading patterns and short-termisms and manipulation for days. But, you know, something else that happened, and again, not to go down into the political spectrum, but for those not intimately familiar with oil markets, Iran, which I didn't mention in the $72 break even, because if they're not allowed to export it, they don't break even anywhere. And if they are able to get some out in the black market, they're not getting benchmark pricing. So a lot of pressure there. But the plan was for them to go under sanctions where they would no longer be to sell into international markets again in early November. And our administration decided to grant them a waiver for 6 months for about 75% of their oil. OPEC doesn't want a price spike. It's actually bad for them if you get $100 oil, $120, $130, because then you start getting the Norwegians and the French and the South Americans doing these massive offshore projects that, you know, a little well in the Permian giving you 2 million barrels is nothing compared to these deep water 50-year resources. But, you know, those projects need 90, 100, 120 to really make sense with a 10% IRR. So ahead of Iran coming offline, the Saudis probably had some discussions with our government, began producing well over where they'd been producing all year, so there wasn't a supply shock when Iran came offline. Unilaterally, and this was for months, we decided to extend those waivers, meaning the United States. So all of a sudden, you have a couple million barrels of extra Saudi and Iranian oil on the market that the market was trying to balance and adjust for it not being there. So all of a sudden you see stockpiles showing up in the United States and you start seeing it abroad and the market plummets and it, very short term because the fundamentals of what's happening. And I should also mention that in the fourth quarter, as oil's deluge continued, the inventory data was really meaningless because none of the production cuts started until the beginning of the year, and you didn't really see the pain points of where certain non-core shale beds would curtail production. So if you have your wells and your drilling crews up and running, you're not going to just take that well offline. So, you know, the balancing act might take another 3 to 4 months until you see it in inventory numbers, but very, very odd situation. And I, in the interest of time, I won't get into it, but I also I'm very, very skeptical of what the Saudis' actual resource base is. The last time that that was inspected and approved by international petroleum engineers was in the late 1970s. They've been producing heavily ever since, and they've revised their proven reserves, basically double what it was when the British and the Americans confirmed those resources 30 years ago. Probably not likely in and of itself, but I think that the Crown Prince pulling the Aramco IPO is also very telling that they probably aren't this perpetual marginal producer of oil. You know, he realizes they need to get away from a purely petroleum-based economy. He wanted to take Aramco public. He wanted to take the chemical business public. He wanted to take the refinery public, but he wouldn't allow international petroleum engineers to confirm the resource. So the world views the Saudi swing production where they can switch on or switch off 2 million barrels a day at their behest as a balancing mechanism, but I don't know if that's going to be a given forever. So enough going into full oil markets. One last point I'd like to touch on is energy securities in and of themselves. I didn't highlight materials because this is more focused, but it applies to the gold royalties as well. Are really orphan securities where, I mean, energy was close to 15% of the S&P 500 a decade ago. Now you're down to 6%. But then if you look at the S&P Energy Index, and this is where 90% of allocators are investing, you know, you've got 40% of the index in Exxon and Chevron, and you've got to go all the way down to Schlumberger until you get a non-E&P. So that's oil field services. The next three are refinery-based companies, and then Halliburton is a service provider. So not only is energy a pariah and an orphan security, there's no passive fund flows, there's no investor demand, but most people don't even know what royalties are. So in closing, I'll do risk disclosures just for our compliance. One thing for those that are have a long-short mandate, I would mention that there's some interesting ways to pair a long oil and gas royalty company such as Viper, where you're getting paid 8% a year. You can short futures on oil prices, depending on, and many times they're in very steep contango. So you can fund your short of the underlying spot commodity through your yield. And to the extent that we believe that the historic economics of royalties are far more attractive than underlying prices, you'll earn the decay of the contango. You can fund the short through a good amount of your yield. It makes a pairs trade or a hedged trade quite intriguing. So with that, I'd like to go back to John and see if there's questions or any feedback. And thank you again, everybody, for giving me the time today.
Well, James, thank you so much for that great presentation, not just in terms of the idea, but it really also serves as a primer on the industry itself. And so for my questions, I'd like to have both more a general angle as well as specific to Viper. How do you think about capital allocation in this space? What ought to be the priorities? Is there room for return of capital here? Or is it really about drilling and finding more resources?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there was a mutiny of sorts amongst large oil investors about halfway through this year, where the old standard, meaning the previous 30 years, investors demanded replace whatever you take out of the ground every year in new resource. So if you're gonna pull up 1 million barrels, you better replace that and make sure that you're not depleting your resource base. Whereas the institutional community came to the drillers this year and said, you need to focus on free cash flow. You need to focus on economic returns to your shareholders and not empire, and not just building an empire. So that is a new dynamic that's going to create a lot more discipline, and you're going to see a lot more strict funding to the extent that people just want to build resource. Now, as it applies to the royalty companies, I personally believe they should prioritize growing their resource base and creating a larger and longer stream of resource, as opposed to distributing 100% of the cash flow. And this really, it goes from the MLP mindset, where you distribute everything and then grow through stock issuance and drop-downs. But if you can buy a highly accretive acre because it's not producing today, I would much rather you buy that acre at a embedded rate of return that's magnitudes higher than your current acreage and forego a dividend today. So it's really about aligning the investor base to a combined component of NAV growth with yield. And that's really the happy median that the gold companies have reached over time, where Franco, even today, it's about a 2% distribution, but they grow NAV tremendously and investors appreciate that. Energy needs to evolve their royalties to have an NAV growth component with a yield component.
Could you talk a little bit more about management incentives and how you think about that? Is high insider ownership the only way to align incentives, or are there other ways as well?
We as a firm are highly skewed towards actual equity skin in the game, where, you know, whether options, restricted stock units, incentive bonuses, I mean, they tend to be short term, and we want you to be able to lose money, not just not earn money in the case of a misstep. So the Diamondback ownership is a very, very strong incentive for the parent company, which is quite large and probably one of the best, if not the one of the best, probably Diamondback and Pioneer in the basin. But individual management at the Viper level are really incentivized through direct stock ownership. But, you know, that's one of the things that I think should be optimized, is they're primarily looking at distribution growth and total shareholder return, which clearly is a large element, but I'd like to see them incentivized to grow NAV in addition to those other metrics.
In your mind, there's obviously a lot of moving things here and data. What are the key data points to really gauge value creation? You talked about a number of the metrics that can be tracked. Which do you think are really critical?
I think the best metric to use, and this is at odds with how Wall Street likes to look at the world, is your net royalty acreage relative to your share count. And that can be reconciled with your production growth and distribution growth. But in terms of evaluating the industry, the well level economics, so how far are they drilling on a lateral basis? In some cases, it's 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 feet, and how many barrels of oil are coming out of that well? And everything that we're showing, that we're seeing, is showing an extremely robust rate of return in the core Delaware and core Midland basins. And this is the preeminent resource, so it's going to be interesting to see where the less robust resources. So you go into SCOOP and STACK in Oklahoma, which are phenomenal, but not quite on the level of the Permian. Same thing with the Eagle Ford. And you obviously have a much higher spread as you go up into the DJ Basin, Powder River Basin, and Williston Basin as you go further north. So at a royalty level, it's really the acreage growth relative to units combined with distributions. And then you really need to keep an eye on the industry itself and just continue to see how much the wells are producing. Are they realizing spot pricing? Are they still getting haircuts? And you know, if all of that kind of congeals well, everybody it should all work out well for everybody in the industry.
This sector obviously offers a lot of interesting opportunities at this time. And by sector, I mean companies tied to crude oil pricing in one way or another. How do you think about going with an E&P company versus more of a service provider, or even further, a little bit further away, some of the tanker companies and others that are leveraged to the energy cycle?
One of the reasons why we like or are so fond of royalties is the minimal or zero use of debt. And you know, you've seen through every cycle a lack of discipline in both gold markets and oil markets, where prices are high, budgets extend, capital markets are friendly, and you take on too much debt and expand capacity that requires high pricing. So we are very, very fond of any E&P company or service provider that has the appropriate balance sheet, which will allow them to continue to weather a prolonged period of cyclical downturn and then have a commensurate capture of the upside. And it's dictated by the business model and the balance sheet. So certain E&Ps, they have wonderful assets, wonderful balance sheets, but it's still very capital intensive. And a lot of that cash flow is reinvested into future production and growing the resource base. Service providers are going to have a tougher time where, especially the offshore providers, but you know, pressure pumping, which is a big part, and frac spreads, there's not a lot of value add. And so if there's too many pressure pumps and too many frac spreads, it's going to be hard for them to get pricing. And, you know, the guys in the Permian and have been able to exert pressure on them time and time again. You mentioned tankers, which I personally am very, very fond of tankers, especially because there's so much waterborne transport to get better pricing and to get better economics. Huge fan of Cheniere Energy, huge fan of Navigators. if you want to go really esoteric, there's an interesting player that American Shipping, which they own Jones Act vessels that are subleased to on day rate charters, giving a guaranteed minimum in the heat, basically mostly in the Gulf. And they then transport oil and gas primarily to Florida because Florida doesn't have pipelines. So at the current base rate of day rate, they're getting about an 8% yield owning the stock, which includes debt amortization. But if the market gets a lot tighter, there's much, much upside. But in that case, they have the right asset in the right place. So again, business model, asset base, and capital structure, and there's some phenomenal ways to play this cycle.
Terrific. Well, we are out of time, James. I'll leave it there. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you with their own thoughts or questions. Of course, we're happy to facilitate an introduction. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us and share such an insightful presentation.
Thank you, John. Talk to you soon.
Goodbye.